a very small unit. But basically, they were waiting to start the ground war till these units were in place and ready to go. So we were, that's why we went so fast. We got everything we needed immediately. If we requested something that normally took 6 months in the supply system, we got it within 8 hours. They flew stuff to us, same day air, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of supplies, same day air.
Right.
Sometimes the shipping was $5,000 or $6,000 for certain pieces of equipment.
That beats the U.S. Postal Service, yeah.
That was even quicker than the military could send it on their own planes.
Wow.
But twice they sent a cargo plane to Fort Stewart with just some equipment for us, nothing else on the plane. Equipment for us. That's how important it was to get us over there.
So were you like a distribution center, basically? Is that
we're a command structure for the ammunition.
Okay.
We are responsible for command and control of all the ordnance units, all the ammunition units. And what the problem was there were enough ammunition units over there, there was just no organization of them.
Mm.
They were all under different commands. And none of the commands were experts in ammunition. So what the problem was is they weren't putting the right, they didn't know how to put the right ammunition in the right place for supply. Okay, so I got off your question a little bit, though.
That's okay. That's okay.
So that's basically why we went so fast. Mm-hmm. Then the trip over, like I said, everything we owned, the unit owned, and everything personally we had went on 2C5As. 100 people. We had 20-some trucks. And
I'm assuming those are really large.
Yeah, that's the largest, at the time, the largest airplane the United States had. All the cargo goes in the belly, and there's passenger seats up in the very top of the plane. One of the things that I considered a problem with the C-5 is the seats are all sitting backwards. So you're flying backwards. It's supposedly a safety thing. If the plane crashes, instead of being thrown forward, you're thrown into the back of the seat. If the plane has a crash landing or a rough landing, and they're made to land on unimproved runways and stuff.
Hmm.
So that's why they do that. But it does make for a certain discomforting ride.
I can imagine.
And the flight was 27 hours in the air.
Wow.
We flew, the plane I was in was loaded 10,000 pounds over legal limit. For peacetime. They threw out the rules for wartime, since we were going into wartime. So we were the heaviest C-5A to ever take off from Fort Stewart, Georgia.
Did you know this before you left?
No. Well, we knew it about 5 minutes before we got on the plane.
That's a little unnerving, isn't it?
Because there was the commander of Fort Stewart was there, and we wondered why this 3-star general would show up to see a 100-man unit leave. And they said, no, he's here to see if the plane will take off. Because nobody's ever taken off. And in fact, my plane was hitting trees at the end of the runway.
Man.
We were hitting pine trees at the end of the runway. You could hear it in the aircraft. We just barely made it up. And because of that, we had to fly to Delaware because Hunter Airfield was not long enough for us to carry a full load of fuel with all the weight we carried. So we only had a partial load of fuel. So we had to fly to Delaware and refuel in Delaware. But one thing about the C-5s, we had worked them to death by this time. And every time we landed, the plane needed extensive maintenance. So we got stuck in Delaware for about 6 hours. Took off from Delaware and flew to Frankfurt, Germany. And stuck there for 14 hours. Then flew to Saudi Arabia. But that's still, we were 27 hours in the air, plus all that downtime. So it was a little over two days by the time we finally got there.
So did they do any in-air refueling while you were flying?
No, we didn't have to do that.
I figure the extra weight, you may have to make use a little bit more fuel.
Yeah. That's why we had to just stop some.
Stop some.
Yeah. We did, on the long layover in Germany, I had the misfortune of getting sick. It was 10 below zero there and 8 feet of snow on the ground. And they stuck us in a tent.
Oh,
a large tent, but still a tent. And it was very cold. And about four or five of us caught the flu or something. But I got sick, but instead of telling anybody, I went and got on the airplane because I didn't want to get left behind. So I was sick from Frankfurt to Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, which is about an 11-hour flight. And, it didn't help the seats were facing backwards.
Yeah, really?
And that we had turbulence most of the way. It was a very rough ride. So I, for one, was very glad when we landed in Saudi Arabia. Although it was kind of an interesting experience.
So you land in Saudi Arabia, and the war has already started by then.
Oh, yes.
So what's the first thing you do?
Well, the first thing we did, we got off the airplane, and, you know, by watching the TV reports and stuff of the war, when the guy's standing there saying, I'm in an airbase somewhere in Saudi Arabia, that was right where we got off the airplane.
Oh, really?
Because there were two F-15s took off right above our airplane and looked just like the first photograph, video I saw of the war, which were two F-15s taking off from Dhahran Air Base.
Oh.
And that's where we landed. In fact, the press pool was 50 feet away from us. You could see all the reporters milling around, and they were doing live reports and stuff.
So, of course, they weren't they weren't telling where they were because Saudi Arabia has CNN as well, right?
Yeah. And we got there at 2 in the morning, Saudi time. It was about 60 or 70 degrees, about 90% humidity. This was February, but it just happened to have a warm spell right there. And we had left 11 hours before, had left Frankfurt at 10 below. So that was kind of a rude awakening. We were loaded down, each man and woman carried about 240 pounds of equipment on them. Everything to live for 6 months. And we had to literally carry it off the airplane. That includes, we had long underwear and all this stuff on. Okay, so we get off the airplane, plop down on the ground, and a guy comes up and says, welcome to Saudi Arabia, and gives us the little spiel, you know, this is here, we're going to put you on buses in a few minutes, take you over to your temporary billeting place. And another unit got off the airplane, another airplane, right in front of us, and they were standing right in front of us. As it turns out, that was the unit that had 28 members killed by a Scud about a week and a half later.
Ooh.
And they took them directly to their barracks, that is the place that got hit. They were going to take us there too, and they found out that we had all our vehicles and equipment with us. And so they said, oh, you'll be going up to the front then, so you don't have to worry about going there. So we did not get sent to that building, which in fact
was closed.
Later got hit, so it was pretty close. Also, within 15 minutes of getting off the aircraft, we had a Scud coming into the airbase. So that was,
and again, for those who don't know what a Scud is, can you explain what that would be?
Scud is a long-range missile that they were fairly inaccurate. Basically, the Iraqis pointed them in the general direction of the port, say, for instance, where we were at the port city of Dhahran. Actually, the port itself is in a little town called Dammam, but we were on a large air base, and so the port and the air base were the two probably major targets of Scuds during the war. And so as we stood there, some of them ran to the bunker, but I wasn't about to run anywhere. I was too sick, so I just kind of laid there on the ground and watched, and a Patriot anti-missile came up and took out the Scud right above us, and there was fireworks, and we found later that there were large pieces of the Scud fell right around us and actually damaged two aircraft, including one of the ones we came in on.
Wow.
Or hit with France.
So, did these Patriots, did they deploy automatically?
No.
Or did
they track automatically? They picked up. They have radars that pick up the incoming missiles, but they have to be fired by a person. Somebody has to make the decision whether to fire or not to fire.
So this war has been basically called the most technological or the most technologically advanced war of history. Do you agree with that?
Oh yeah. Although we still used a lot of conventional, dumb bombs and dumb artillery and stuff. But obviously the technology is what made all the difference casualty-wise. We would have still won the war. The difference would have been the amount of casualties. We had things like global positioning radar systems that was a little handheld box that'll tell you where you are in the world within 10 meters.
Wow.
In the desert, that is... just makes all the difference in the world.
You have no landmarks, really.
There's no landmarks at all where we were. You could not... A compass would give you basic general direction to go, but you could not tell anywhere where you were with a compass. About the only thing you had to halfway do things like that was your odometer on your vehicle and a compass. But still, that was so inaccurate. When we tried to use those systems, you would get off hundreds of miles off. So, and this is what the Iraqi army was using, was compasses. And they didn't have global position radar. Some of our weapon systems that... there was a new missile that we were using called an ATACMS that is... fired out of the multiple launch rocket system, but instead of six rockets in a pod, there's one big one, and it goes up and it looks for metal on the battlefield. It flies over, you point it in the general direction, and it goes up and looks for metal, and when it finds metal, it deploys thousands of bomblets. Some of those bomblets are anti-armor bomblets, and some of them are anti-personnel bombings, which kill people. So you kill people and armored vehicles. We use these, for instance, the Iraqis were well known for their artillery units. They really hurt the Iranians in the Iran-Iraq war with artillery. And so when they started, as soon as they started firing their artillery at us, we fired back one ATACMS at them using our radar. We could trace the round they fired at us. We could trace its trajectory back by looking at its flight through the air. You could trace its trajectory back, know where they are within 100 meters.
Incredible.
Send one of these ATACMS up. It would find the unit, scatter the bomblets. When the bomblets hit, they sent over a special forces team to take a look, and there was not a single solitary soul left.
Wow.
They completely annihilated the battery, which is about a 200-man unit, and completely destroyed every single piece of equipment.
Absolutely.
They said all there was dead bodies and blown up equipment. One round.
Just one.
That's
wild.
So when the word got out with the Iraqi military that this is what happened every time you fired a round, after a while they quit firing.
Yeah.
It was very difficult for them to get their units. You know, their higher command would order a fire mission, and they'd go, okay, we fired it, and they wouldn't do anything. So
they were kind of wimping out after that, basically. Yeah.
When the word got out, it didn't take long for a lot of units to actually just quit fighting right then.
So what are some of the main points that stick out in your mind as far as the war? Some things that happened to you. I know on television we saw several things like the surrender, of course, the few that surrendered or whatever that was.
Yeah. For me, it was totally different because, we weren't involved in direct combat.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that stick out in my mind were like 1,000 vehicle convoys, munition convoys going out the morning of the battle. And just the tremendous amount of ammunition we had to deal with. We received somewhere around 150 to 180 shiploads of ammunition. All that had to be unloaded off the ships, trucked into the interior. Where I was located was northern Saudi Arabia.
So by the interior, you mean warfront, right?
Yeah.